Hi, I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design, because justice, of course, doesn't just happen on its own. So in this podcast, I talk to the people who are on the ground finding solutions to some of the most pressing issues in our society. You know, I learned an interesting fact this week. 1 in 20 kids will have some sort of experience, interaction with the child protective custody system. Just think about that. That's at least a kid in about every average classroom. And it's not just the child, of course, who has that experience. It's the family, the parents and other custodial family members who go through that experience too. And the stakes are high. Someone can lose custody of their child or even be brought up on criminal charges. But even if criminal charges don't result in they're just going through the civil child protective services system, that doesn't have all of the constitutional protections that we think about, for example, in a criminal court, you know, the right to an attorney, the right to remain silent without that being used against you, and other crucial protections, the right to not have a warrantless search. But that does happen in these situations because it is a civil proceeding. And that can impose all kinds of burdens, particularly on parents or custodial adults who may have been born in another country or who speak a different language or who have a disability or are low income earning and don't have all of the same wherewithal that others do. And as I said, the results could be potentially devastating. You know, I'm a lawyer and I understand the differences between civil and criminal law when it comes to proceedings and protections, but I was really shocked when I looked into this at what the differences really could mean. So that is why I am so glad I am joined today by Anjana Samant. She is a senior attorney with the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. Anjana, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit, introduce yourself to our listeners, who you are and what you do there at ACLU.
Sure. So my name is Anjana Samant. I use she, her pronouns. As Kimberly mentioned, I'm a senior counsel with the ACLU Women's Rights Project. And my work in the project revolves entirely around the constitutional rights, due process protections, civil liberties interests, as they are implicated by what we call the child welfare system. You know, WRP's goal and our work is really driven by our vision of a society where women and girls are afforded dignity and autonomy so that they can realize their full potential. Restrictions on our bodily choices, you know, I think we usually think of that most immediately and certainly in today's world, taking the form of limiting access to medical care or reproductive health care, while that has really been seen for decades, if not longer, as the prime way in which authorities exert control over women, so too does the child welfare system, right? The child welfare system intervenes where it believes that there is inadequate or inappropriate or unfit parenting. And the problem really is here, while local investigation procedures, evidentiary thresholds vary from one jurisdiction to the next, child welfare law really is structured around this baseline assumption that it's parental fault here, right? And what happens is that you have caseworkers who are tasked with supporting the same parents that they're also supposed to be investigating, prosecuting, which gives them contradictory mandates. Mm. They're both supposed to refer parents and families to services, but they're also supposed to act much like police officers and gather any information that could be marshaled against them as evidence of their unfitness. Women and children who are Indigenous, who are Black, who are experiencing poverty are disproportionately placed under child welfare scrutiny. And once there, Indigenous, Black families in particular, and parents with disabilities fare far worse than their white counterparts or families without any disabled family members at nearly every critical step. And in part, yes, these disparities are the legacy of past social practices and government policies that, for instance, used child removal practices to effectively commit genocide against Indigenous peoples, and also through slavery and post-official slavery, dismantle Black families and undermine Black communities. But the disparities are also the result of the continued policing of women in particular in recent decades through public benefits laws, that through the failed war on drugs, through criminal justice policies, all of which who basically punish women, limit their access to social supports because they fail to conform to particular conceptions of what a fit mother is.
Wow. I really appreciate that history lesson because it's so important for people to remember the origin, how we got the laws we have now and why they are in place and why they work the way that they do. I think a lot of times people think about when child welfare services are called into a situation that there is some sort of neglect, that there is some sort of abuse or worse, and there often is, and there is this idea that they really need to be tough in these situations to protect children. But it's so important to realize the inequities in the system and how they can manifest. And there was there is a case that you are working on, which I think brings in multiple factors that we've highlighted all in one case. And it's not just affecting women, the mother in this case, but the father too. Can you tell us a little bit about that case?
Sure. So this is a case in New York City. And it's about a father, Wen Zi, and the mother, Zhao Y, whose son was removed from them when he was an infant. And he was placed in the New York City foster system after mom experienced a mental health episode, was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and the city concluded that she posed a risk to her son. Now, over the course of 10 years, the foster care agency, which is legally required to expend what are called diligent efforts to reunify a family, failed to provide such efforts. Absolutely. Even though, in the end, earlier this year, a family court terminated both Wen and Zhao's parental rights separately. And it was in order to do so, it was required to first find that the agency had, in fact, expended diligent efforts. Even though the family court granted the termination order, it still said, you know what, the agency's efforts are, quote, minimal, quote, it should have done more, and even had not at that time complied with some of the court's outstanding orders. Now, so where we are now is, since the termination of those parental rights, when, who is again the father, is represented by the Center for Family Representation, is asking New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals, to hear his request to reverse the termination, and on the grounds that the agency did not, in fact, present clear and convincing evidence that it did provide diligent efforts. Minimal efforts just don't meet that standard. Mm-hmm. Where the ACLU Women's Rights Project comes in is we have filed a brief in support of the father, urging the Court of Appeals to take the case, because the record also shows that the agency discriminated against the parents on the basis of the mom's disability, right? So federal and state law prohibit foster agencies from providing lesser supports or services to a family just because the parent has a disability. This means that you have to take the disability into account when the agency is doing its job, its legal mandate of providing services to bring the family together. They have to reasonably accommodate the disability or modify the services to meet the needs, the individualized needs of that parent. So one example, and this one's really obvious, is that you cannot give a parent who is blind written material that provides information about better parenting skills that aren't in Braille. That's discrimination,
right?
Federal law also says, and this is what's at issue here, is that you can't discriminate against someone because they're associated with a person with a disability, much like federal and state laws say that you can't discriminate against someone because they're associated with, married to someone based on their race. There's a very similar prohibition when it comes to disability protections. And in this case, however, that's exactly what happened to the father. The foster care agency here argued that his parental rights should be terminated because he had, quote, limited insight into his wife's disability. And they gave the example of, for instance, the father thought it was perfectly fine to leave their son alone with Zhao, his mom. But at no time did the agency refer the father to any services or provide information or educate him to help him understand how her schizophrenia limited her ability to be a parent, or help the dad come up with ways to parent safely, notwithstanding whatever limitations she may have. Yeah. So you can think of it this way, right? If a foster agency comes in and they say, okay, you know what, here the parent doesn't understand how to feed or meet the nutritional needs of their newborn, they might send them to a class or refer them to a nutritionist or an appropriate medical provider. They don't throw up their hands and say, well, the parent has limited insight into how to feed their child, so court, you need to terminate the parental rights because this parent is a risk to the child. But that's exactly what they did in this case. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's the unequal and discriminatory treatment that's going on here.
And in this case, it also highlights the fact that if you have other barriers in place, the discrimination sort of multiplies or increases exponentially. You have somebody who is not a native English speaker. You have cultural differences, and you have someone dealing with something that even if there's not a language barrier or a income barrier or any other kind, when you're dealing with very serious disabilities, that can be hard to manage, yeah, even with the best of care. So just expecting that to already be in place in a situation like that, that sounds pretty unrealistic to me.
Oh, absolutely. And this is an issue that was addressed in another brief that was filed in support of the father on behalf of the Asian American Legal Defense Fund by an amazing lawyer, Carolyn Kubitschek. But what they talked about is the evidence in this case is overwhelming that the foster agency did not provide any linguistically or culturally appropriate reunification services or even evaluations of the parent's skills. So just as disability discrimination is prohibited by federal and state law in the child welfare system, so is discrimination based on national origin. And what that translates into is that foster agencies must provide interpretation services, for instance, so that a non-English speaking family or immigrant family is treated on par with an English speaking or non-immigrant family that is involved with them. And here, so Wen and Zhao have lived in the US, largely in New York City, for over 30 years. They speak Fuzhou, that's a language that's spoken in part of China, and they do not speak English. Wen also has a very limited understanding of Mandarin, which I think is what most people assume individuals from China speak. Nevertheless, for the first year that their son was in foster care, the foster agency assumed they spoke Mandarin, which is not equivalent with Fuzhou, and used Mandarin interpreters. And then when interpreters weren't available, canceled conferences with the parent that would have laid out, okay, this is how we, the agency, believe you can safely parent together, or this is the requirements you need to meet to demonstrate to us that your child will not be in danger. And maybe even more, just this is especially as someone who is a multilingual speaker from birth, this guts me, but The agency here provided no interpretation to the father during the visits he had with his sons during the first 4 years of his life, right? So nor did they find or any language classes, play groups, or anything like that, or culturally appropriate ones for their son while he was in foster care.
So he was in foster care from infancy learning English.
Exactly. He was placed in four foster homes, none of which spoke Fuzhou or even Mandarin. Mm. And, you know, one thing that, you know, people might think, okay, well, how common is that language? In New York City, as was discussed in this brief, in New York City, since the 80s, over 300,000 people who have migrated from China are come from the Fuzhou province or speak Fuzhou. It is not an obscure language in New York City, right? It is something where this family lives and where this agency operates. There are, in fact, culturally appropriate service providers. There are organizations that can help find families that would be appropriate foster placements. There are ways to find therapists. There are ways to find child care centers, right, that really could have fostered this sense of cultural belonging. And again, as you put it, this child was removed from infancy and for 10 years never learned his parents' primary language, yeah, right? And I, you know, there's one example that I think of, you know, when I think I should clarify, it wasn't until their son was 7 years old that finally the agency found a language class for him. Ugh. You know, and the reality is a child has a right to the love and care of their parents, even while they're in foster care, until that parent is found to be unfit. Until yeah. those parental rights are terminated, the parent is supposed to get information and have a say in their education and in their upbringing. And yeah. that didn't happen here.
You know, it's so interesting because I talk here and also on hashtag Sisters-in-Law, my other podcast, about the difference between criminal and civil proceedings, and that there's a reason why you know, you think about the differences, right? When you have a criminal proceeding, your life and or your liberty could be at stake. You know, the stakes are very, very high. So you have all these constitutional protections for a defendant. Whereas in most civil proceedings, those things aren't at stake. So you don't have the same level of protection. But here, I mean, protecting the child as well as the parents, protecting something you can't get back, the connection during those formative years, to have that be at this lower standard yeah. is really, it's gobsmacking.
Yeah. I mean, you know, parents have repeatedly said that losing their parental rights was the same as the civil death penalty, mm. you know,
yeah.
and yet under the Constitution to this day, there is no constitutionally protected right to a lawyer when a parent is facing not just investigations, but when is facing termination. Now, through state court decisions and state statutes, most places have created some form of a right. But even in a lot of cases, in a lot of instances, the discretion is left up to the judge to decide, is this the type of case that is so complicated enough that the parent is actually, if they can't afford one, has a right to a lawyer? And that still doesn't exist. It's absolutely terrifying. And even in states where you do have a right to a lawyer, and I think the parallels to the criminal context are just so appropriate here, right? Getting a lawyer or being able to say when police lock at your door or when child welfare knocks at your door, why are you here? I'm not letting you in. I want to call my lawyer, right? When the police are there, that is absolutely essential to protecting you. You don't have those rights when child welfare is there. I think I would say people argue, and I certainly would take the position that actually child welfare does have to get a warrant in order to force themselves into your home. But by the time a lawyer is appointed, right, I think one thing that also and I'm relatively new to this space, but something that I didn't appreciate is that most child welfare investigations don't actually end up in court. And the problem is in most states, that right to a lawyer isn't triggered until those court proceedings starts.
Right.
So that means you could have an investigation going on, again, where these child welfare workers are required to both report on you and help you for years and never have that right to a lawyer triggered.
Wow. So you don't have the right to a lawyer. You don't have a right to silence and have that not be held against you, your silence, because in civil proceedings, you can take silence from a witness and make a negative inference about the decision of the witness to not speak or answer a question. It's the opposite as with a criminal. And then you also have these warrantless searches that I agree with you. I would also think that that would be considered custodial and that should trigger Fourth Amendment protections, but they happen all of the time. So in your experience on the ground, seeing this, what reforms do you think are necessary in order to alleviate some of these injustices?
Absolutely. So I think there are some kind of legal reforms, very kind of as the lawyer, but I would be unfair if I didn't point out that a lot of the reforms that I, and some of the ones that I'm going to mention, are coming from impacted families. It's an amazing place right now because so many impacted parents, families, former foster youth have begun mobilizing. And we're at this point where they really are taking leadership and saying, this is, you want to know how to help us? Don't keep sending us to these services. Ask us what we need, and we will tell you what we need and what will help us. So in that vein, one of the things that a lot of folks have been arguing for is a type of Miranda rights for families. And so that would mean when child welfare shows up, they are actually legally obligated to tell you what your rights are in that state. And I would add, there are states where people don't realize, but they actually do have a statute that says, oh, parents have a Bill of Rights when child welfare shows up, and they are supposed to be informed of them, but agencies routinely flout that. So one, Miranda rights and ensuring that agencies actually provide that information as required. Number two, narrowing the definition of neglect. You know, I think people don't realize because we see, unfortunately, we always see the horror stories, which are absolutely abominable, never should happen, but they are a striking minority of the cases. Across the country, statistics are somewhere between 68 to 72% of substantiated cases are about neglect. And while the definition varies from state to state, pretty much every place has this catch-all bucket, which is neglect occurs when a caretaker acts or fails to act in a way that creates an immediate risk of harm to the child. So based on that definition, you have people who sent their 10-year-old to the corner store, right, or to the playground across the street where they can watch them from the window of their apartment, and they are now suddenly called up on child neglect charges, right? So narrowing the definition of neglect so that we really are not bringing in people who are either encouraging independence in their kids, or also, as you started pointed out at the start of this episode, right, are facing instability, whether that's housing instability, and maybe they're living in a car, maybe they're living in a motel, they haven't been able to get their kids' clothes washed. Do they need to be supervised and basically put on probation for being a bad parent? No, they need assistance finding housing, finding services. So narrowing the definition of neglect. Another very important piece, and this is something that is for now enshrined in federal law, is we need to replace mandatory reporting with permissive reporting. So mandatory reporting is a whole swath of professions. Healthcare providers, police, teachers are required to call child welfare when they suspect that neglect or abuse is happening. And I think definitely, and especially you see this, I think, with a lot of teachers, right? They see that kid come in and they're hungry and they can't focus by 11. They may call child welfare thinking that they're actually connecting this family with services. The problem is they're connecting this family with a very much a surveillance system, right? They don't realize, and in a lot of places, the question is like, well, where else do we go? How else do we connect these folks? But the problem is, and then once you're in that system, like I said, the caseworker is both your helper and you're a probation officer.
Yeah.
And then when they send you to services, right, if I'm sent to an anger management class or a parenting class, those service providers are also mandatory reporters. So it's hard for me to trust the system. And it's terrifying, right? Like one small misstep, right? I can't take this day off from work. Last minute, my boss says, no, you're not going to get the afternoon off to pick up your kid early. Now suddenly, that's a demerit against me about my parenting skills.
Oh, wow. I want to talk about this a little more because we think about a similar issue in the criminal interaction with the criminal justice system, where, you know, there's an incident, maybe somebody is having a mental health crisis and the police are called, and we think, yes, okay, well, a police officer is not the best person in most of these circumstances. This person needs assistance. They need services. They need help. They don't need law enforcement. But in this case, that it's the same. This is a child welfare system where services are meant to be offered, but because it is also sort of a enforcement, yes, arm too, and they are don't this person doesn't have any leeway. They don't have any ability to say, okay, this, I see what's going on here. I understand why this person needs services, so I'm not going to make it worse and compound that by reporting it in a way that is going to imperil their ability to keep custody. But they don't, absolutely, have a choice here. It's mandatory.
Absolutely. Mm. And so that still addresses, I think, people's concerns about, like, well, if someone's, you can still call,
yeah,
but there isn't an over-reporting, right? There isn't that. I think that's a huge concern.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, another right to counsel. Right. Yeah. I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to say right to counsel.
I hear you.
But I think, and another piece I would say is, and this, we've seen pilot projects in different jurisdictions in different cities across the country. And there was a national pilot project of this during COVID, but direct cash transfers, right? Rather than taking this very condescending, we're going to send you to these services, and you know, that's what your problem as the parent is. How about letting the parent who knows, who is an expert in their experience, the parent and the family that is the expert in what their needs and challenges are, give them the cash so they can decide, okay, I'm going to allocate this much towards rent, this much towards this. This week I can pay for a babysitter, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And we did that during COVID. I think people forget that we had direct cash transfers. And I would love to see more of that and more exploration of those pilot projects that have had success, where families involved in the child welfare system were given this type of supplement, and this actually helped them get on their feet.
I think that's so important because I think the pandemic, we learned and quickly forgot so many important lessons about what works. I mean, everything from voting rights to the way we delivered healthcare to the way we worked. And a lot of those things are going out of the window. But take something like that, which we saw and we know that it's effective. What a perfect thing to model and expand and, you know, ramp up, as opposed to saying, okay, the pandemic's over, let's go back to doing things the way we did before, which wasn't as effective. Do the laws need to be changed, Anjana? Do we need more state and federal laws, or is this a situation where the legal structure is there? It's about the will to implement and do things differently within the legal structure.
There needs to be, you know, a radical overhaul of the legal system. Like I said, for instance, the mandatory reporting provision, it's required by federal law if states want to access certain funds. Right? So that has to change there, right? We need a right to counsel that's actually enshrined. Federal law is one way to do it if we can't trust that the constitutional interpretation will change, right? We need to have people who are no longer both simultaneously reporting on and trying to catch people. Like, again, this probation mindset needs to shift, right? And I think the other thing that I often think of in this case is, right? People are like, well, you know, some families, when they get referred, they'll be referred again. And again, a lot like, let's talk about the disparities. Let's also talk about, like, in the criminal legal system, you get arrested once, odds are much higher that you will be again in the future. There's a similar kind of revolving door. And rather than assuming that it's because there's something wrong with that parent or that family, how about we also look at maybe the services we keep sending these people to aren't working, right? Yeah. So, you know, and I wish I had started off with this. You know, I use the language of the child welfare system because I think it's what people are most familiar with. But, yeah. You know, in light of everything that we've talked about, I would have to say, people are talking about it as it's not a child welfare system. We really need to be talking about it and referring to it as a family regulation or family policing system. Because using this phrase of child welfare also, you know, suggests that kids who are pulled into the system are benefiting and this is actually for their good. But the reality is unfortunately, even if there are kids who absolutely must be pulled out of their home situations, children, young people in foster care, unfortunately have lower educational attainment, are more likely to be involved with the criminal legal system, have a lot higher rates of PTSD and emotional disturbance and need therapy and need help and are really suffering from trauma. And that's even in situations where maybe they're placed in a place that's healthy, right?
Yeah.
But removing a child from their family is extremely traumatizing and difficult to understand. So, you know, I think that language is something that drives home really how the system is functioning.
Yeah, words really matter. And this is a prime example of that. Anjana Saman, thank you for your work in this area, first and foremost. That is appreciated. And I also appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this. This is an issue that I certainly did not understand very well at all before today. And I am a lawyer and I'm pretty well versed in what's going on in the legal system. And I think that this is very eye-opening for me. And I know it is for our listeners as well. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And really, I genuinely thank you because we need more people reporting about this, talking about this. That's so, so important for those of us who don't have contact with the system or don't know families that have been impacted it. So thank you.
Words matter indeed, and it also matters the laws that are in place when the stakes are high and the way the laws are implemented when the stakes are high. There's nothing higher when it comes to one's family and one's upbringing and the chances that we get. We often talk about how zip codes make such a big difference in the lives we lead, where we're born, but certainly the homes where we're brought up makes an incredible difference to the potential of the lives that each of us can lead. And so I am super grateful for Anjana and everyone at ACLU and other agencies that are thinking outside of the box and keeping an eye on this and looking for better solutions so that we can treat our children and our families better. Thank you so much for listening to Justice by Design. Would you do me a favor? And if you enjoy this podcast, tell somebody about it. Tell your husband or your pastor or anyone else in your life who you think might be interested in it too. And also, if you can go wherever you get your pods and give the podcast 5 stars in the review, that helps find other people find the podcast. It sort of tinkers with the algorithm and makes sure that other people can enjoy it too. And make sure you follow me and Justice by Design where you get your podcast. And also, if you have an idea for a future topic that you'd like to see me explore, I am on socials, well, all of them but one, at Kimberly E. Atkins. Drop an idea in my mentions. I'm always looking for that. Thanks again, and I'll see you next week on Justice by Design.